Hollywood Scandals is part of the Dark Hollywood Collection in the Reels Files on Podcast One, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Be sure to subscribe for new episodes each Thursday. Then go to Reels.com, check the top of the screen, and enter your zip code to find out how you can watch more chilling cases like this when you watch TV. That's R-E-E-L-Z.com for the dark crime series and specials you'll find only on Reels Channel.
We have a fascination with evil. And it's the evil state of the human condition that's terrifying.
Charles Manson left prison with dreams of becoming famous.
He wanted to be known as a rock star.
The Beach Boys are going to record one of his songs. A record producer is interested. Manson's on his way to being Jim Morrison.
His charisma is magnetic, attracting followers who worship him.
Young girl, supposedly under the spell of a bearded Svengali.
The women look like the girl down the street, the girl next door.
They actually believe that Charles Manson is Jesus Christ.
But when he doesn't get what he wants, the real Manson is revealed.
Never tell a sociopathic narcissist, you're not that good. There will be hell to pay.
The man obsessed with becoming famous will fulfill his desires by becoming infamous. And his legacy will be written with blood.
There was complete terror in the Hollywood community.
I mean, it was a total bloodbath.
It's all a matter of time now.
These were peaceful women turned into horrible, horrible killers.
I can do anything I want to you people at any time I want to.
August 9th, 1969. A mass murder of unspeakable horror occurs at an upscale Hollywood home. Shockingly, three of the killers are young and female. But the bloody crime is masterminded by the embodiment of evil. A bearded psychopath named Charles Manson.
It's so abstract that someone has to carry insanity. Someone's got to be insane. Someone's got to be the bad guy. If I wanted to kill somebody, I'd take this book and beat you to death with it, and I wouldn't feel a thing.
They are the terrifying thoughts of a maniacal madman.
You look at those eyes, and it's almost like you're looking at death. And that's a very scary thing.
A master manipulator who abused everyone around him.
I'm not asking you. I'm telling you. You do exactly what I say.
Charles Manson enters prison, a frail young boy. But behind prison walls, he grows into a dangerous man with apocalyptic visions of an impending race war.
Maybe I should have killed 400 or 500 people. Then I would have felt better. Then when I felt like I really offered society something.
A man with wild dreams of a Hollywood recording career, Charles Manson's hunger for the spotlight runs so deep, he's willing to play any role he can get.
I'm the man in here. And that's a fact.
Born on November 12, 1934, Charles Manson's quest for adulation and power grows out of a childhood in which he has neither.
I've been an outlaw ever since I was born.
Manson had a really, really bad childhood. His father left. His mother became an alcoholic and a prostitute.
She tried to hustle a few dollars on the corner, but there wasn't no money.
He had the proverbial, torturous, horrible stepfathers.
Mother's boyfriend really didn't like him, sent him to school in a dress, you know, called him a sissy, a baby.
He was shamed that way growing up. And then to escape it, he went out on the streets.
Out on the street, Manson resorts to robbery and burglary to survive. It isn't long before he's in trouble with the law.
At 12 years old, after a life of petty crime up to that point, he's sent off to this Catholic reform school where he just simply learns to be a better criminal.
Then he goes to these horrible southern detention camps for kids. He was a good-looking guy and he's small. So in a youth prison, you're just dead meat. He's raped by older kids. He's raped by the guards. He's raped by the prison administrator. He had an absolutely horrific upbringing.
When you have a child that goes through that type of dysfunctional upbringing, that becomes their norm. Life is all about being violent. Life is about survival of the fittest. Life is about if you don't take care of yourself, no one else will. And survive any way you can.
Each one of you is somebody. I am nobody. But then now I'm alive. My mother went to prison and left me. And everybody's lied to me.
At age 17, Manson rapes a young boy while holding a razor to his throat. Authorities label Manson dangerous and transfer him to the federal reformatory in Petersburg, Virginia.
Charles Manson had to survive in prison. And prison is animalistic.
If I show any weakness, if I fall down in any perspective, I get ate up because I run with a pack of wolves and I got to be a wolf.
He would have eye contact with people. And this is what you hear again and again. Charles Manson had these eyes that would sort of mesmerize you. That was his trait.
He was a little dog growling and snarling and looking into your soul like he's going to rip your heart out. And he had to develop his famous burning eye look to survive in a prison.
I have to propose a certain image and keep a certain kind of guy stuck up there to keep those bullies off of me.
Manson has learned how to survive in prison, but he's developing a sociopathic need for power. Little Charlie wants to be followed and obeyed.
While in prison, he went out of his way to learn how to manipulate people. Not that he didn't do it well already. And he took the Dale Carnegie course, How to Win Friends and Influence People.
Sincerity and honesty, he said, will do it. It'll trick them every time. I said, well, sincere and honesty, I never tried that.
He was really drawn into books about how to manipulate people, psychology, how to grow popularity, how to make people like you and then follow you.
All I did was watch and learn everything I could from everybody I ever met.
He learned everything there from hypnotism to encounter games. And he was also taught about Scientology in prison. And so that enhanced his wisdom of how to exploit people's weaknesses.
Inside prison, Manson is obsessed with not only obtaining power, but being admired and followed. And when he discovers a new music group from England on television, he sees a way to get all three at once.
When Charlie Manson was incarcerated, he was introduced to the music of the Beatles. And that so inspired him, he started fashioning himself as some sort of budding singer-songwriter.
Charlie used to sit and play his guitar and sing, make up songs and sing.
Manson becomes a competent guitar player and songwriter, but his narcissism and vanity quickly take over. The convict places himself on par with the biggest musical group in the world.
Manson was a budding musician and felt that he had talent and felt that he could be a superstar. So it's not surprising that he focused in on probably the biggest music act of the day, the Beatles. But at the end of the day, this is a psychotic brain latching on to something which has no rational basis in any type of thought.
He felt like he would be, you know, the troubadour to the world.
Grandiose dreams of stardom fill Manson's head. He intends to do whatever it takes to achieve it.
He meets a guy in prison called Phil Kaufman. Phil Kaufman, you might know, is going to be the person who will be in charge of Gram Parsons and Gram Parsons' bands, the Flying Burrito Brothers. Kaufman tells him there are people in San Francisco that can listen to his music.
1967. 32-year-old Charles Manson, who has spent more than half his life in the brutal, ruthless environment of prison, is released on parole. He heads to San Francisco during the Summer of Love, ground zero of the hippie movement.
I went outside and all these little kids got a hold of me and said, we want to stop the Vietnam War and we want to do this. Whoa, it was a war. I don't know what's happening. I sweep the floor in the kitchen, go out and play handball.
He comes out in this world where it's hippies, it's peace and love. It's the most fascinating thing about that is he's homeless. And homelessness was cool. The hippies in San Francisco and Haight-Ashbury, they were homeless.
You have in the 1960s a widespread countercultural move to think outside the norm, to dream and envision different models of society. It hadn't become mainstream, but it certainly became part of the zeitgeist at the time. And Manson fit right in there, of course.
For Manson, schooled in the art of mind control and manipulation, San Francisco is a target-rich environment. And as if out of the rock star playbook, Manson, now recording and performing music, starts to build his groupie following.
He finds he's able to manipulate this hippie culture, and he didn't consider himself a hippie.
I was a beatnik in the 50s before the hippies came along.
He claims he's a beatnik. Now, we may not make much of a differentiation between the two words, but he certainly did. I don't think he saw himself as a hippie because I think he saw the hippies as his prey. The San Francisco culture to him was just simply ripe for those that would keep him supported and those that would worship him, if you will.
Charles Manson was a classic cult leader. He had the charisma. He could adapt to what people wanted to hear. He could assess someone's personality. Basically a BS artist, you would say it, as they all are, but a very, very good one.
These charismatic, pathological narcissists target those people who are fed up with life, they're disillusioned, they're unhappy, they have no support system, and they're searching for something, greater meaning, someone who cares, someone who has some answers.
The whole 10-20-step process he used to seduce all these young women and how it worked, find out what they were into, find out what their problem was, find out what they were escaping, why they were in San Francisco, if they were runaways, if they were unhappy college students, what was it they were searching for? And then he would become that, and he would transform into what they were searching for.
Vulnerable and easy to influence, the women who are seduced by Manson, both as a lover and a father figure, have mostly come to San Francisco to get away from troubled home lives. Like 20-year-old Patricia Krenwinkle. To Manson, she is the perfect doe-eyed prey.
Charlie took Patricia Krenwinkle to an apartment. Patricia had a physical problem where she was covered with hair. And she said that he took her to the full-length mirror and he had her take off all of her clothes. And he said, "Isn't that the most beautiful thing you've ever seen?" And he had her hooked. That was it.
Manson attracts his followers one by one, seducing them, taking away their inadequacies, their fears, and ultimately, their control.
All they had was the belonging to the group, to the cult. That's how they defined themselves. And the more and more bizarre the rules got, well, you've only got the group members to talk it over with, and everyone believes the same thing, and everyone is embracing the same concept.
These were just totally naive children. So he figured out a way to get them, to manipulate them, to kind of worship him and to kind of view him as a leader, as a father figure, and ultimately as a god.
For Manson, he's achieved his first step to fame. But beneath his charismatic exterior is a brutal monster, hungry for more.
Never tell a sociopathic narcissist, "You're not that good. There will be hell to pay."
I think when that started falling apart, drugs started to take over, and I think he kind of snapped.
...1967. As the summer of love winds down, Charles Manson and the group of women he dubs Charlie's Girls head to Los Angeles to fulfill his destiny. He's convinced the young women that he's a leader, someone to be followed and obeyed. But he needs to prove to the world that he's a star.
If you wanted to become a rock star in the 1960s, San Francisco was great, but everybody secretly knew that to really get the money, you had to come down to Los Angeles.
In his head, he had an album's worth of songs. So now the goal was to go to Hollywood and become a famous rock star. And he rides out there, and he has got this bus, and he's got all these beautiful women, and he's got something that the celebrities who have already made it don't even have.
With his brood in tow, Manson immerses himself into the Hollywood music scene.
You have to remember the time. Everybody was a hippie. Everybody had long hair. Everybody played a guitar. And that's how Charlie met these people. And it was very easy to do. That's what Hollywood and West Hollywood was all about then.
You went to the Whiskey, you went to the Troubadour, you went to one of the folk clubs on Sunset. And he had this kind of personality which would get him noticed, which would get him to be able to, you know, sidle up to one of these people at a bar. When Neil Young met Charlie Manson, he really took to him. He really thought there was some talent there.
Charlie thought Jim Morrison was a good guy. Mama Cass was one of his best friends. So he lived in that world. He was like one of those people.
Manson uses his charisma to make friends and influence people. Working the circuit, Manson continues his pursuit of fame. But his biggest break comes as a result of blind luck.
Dennis Wilson picked up two of Manson's prettiest girls hitchhiking.
Dennis Wilson is the drummer for the Beach Boys, and the Beach Boys are the American Beatles. They are about as big a rock band as you can get. And he takes them back to his house, and he has sex with them. Well, the next day, he says, you guys can stay here. I have to do some recording. When Dennis Wilson arrives back from his recording session, the whole family has moved into his house. And Manson meets Wilson in the driveway, drops to his knees, and kisses his feet. And for a while, it's this wonderful symbiotic relationship. You know, Wilson wants sex and drugs, which Manson can provide. And Manson wants an in into the music industry, which Wilson can provide.
To Manson, who studied cults in prison, the eight women who now make up his so-called family are merely pawns to be mercilessly used in his pursuit of fame.
So he lets this scraggly hippie and all his loose girls that would have sex on a drop of a dime, and he lets them move into his house.
In Wilson, Manson sees a ticket to stardom. He knows he's only a heartbeat from the fame he's always craved.
Dennis Wilson of the Beach Boys was so enamored of Charlie Manson that he actually recorded a couple of his songs. In turn, Dennis Wilson introduced Charlie Manson to a very powerful producer by the name of Terry Melcher.
Terry Melcher, son of Doris Day, worked for Columbia Records as a producer, was known as a kind of star maker, somebody who was on the scene, who had a lot of power.
Wilson's attention inflates Manson's already high opinion of himself. He believes he's on his way to major stardom.
He's close to fame. He can see it, he can smell it, he can taste it. The Beach Boys are going to record one of his songs. Now he's got a record producer who's willing to do a demo tape. Manson's on his way to being Jim Morrison.
But before Manson gets to audition for Melcher, he and his family wear out their welcome at Dennis Wilson's house.
Manson and his followers become the kind of worst house guests in the history of American culture and basically move in to Dennis Wilson's home and refuse to leave. They eat all of his food, make him pay for gonorrhea exams and treatment.
Manson's taking over and starting to make demands. And he's nagging Wilson to record his songs.
Fed up with Manson, Wilson goes on tour and directs his manager to kick the family out of the house.
So now Manson is enraged. He wants to kill Dennis Wilson.
With his eye still on Hollywood, but his meal ticket gone, Manson relocates the family to the decaying Spawn Movie Ranch in Los Angeles County.
It's a perfect emblem of kind of crumbling Hollywood stardom. And this becomes the place where Manson and the family set up, agreeing to do odd jobs around just so they can live in this place.
Institutionalized individuals don't do well out in the world, and they know that. They really can't deal with the world. So instead, they try to limit the world that they can deal with.
At the ranch, Manson, for the first time, allows men to join the family, including a drug dealer from Texas named Charles Tex Watson.
Charlie would have you go to bed with one of his teenage girls, get you loaded and have you go to bed with him, then you're obligated to him. And you got to do as he says, or else you're dead.
Charles Manson got the girls first, and the girls attracted guys who just wanted to get stoned and have sex.
May 1969. Manson gets a royal surprise. Record producer Terry Melcher shows up at the ranch to listen to his music.
Terry Melcher, he comes in, he listens to Charles Manson's music, and later on said, "No, your music isn't what I want to hear."
His ego crushed, Manson doesn't just refuse to take no for an answer. He begins plotting his revenge against Melcher.
What's interesting is Charlie Manson's primary motive was fame. Fame by way of being accepted as a great artist, as a great singer and a great songwriter. However, a guy like him, who was given multiple opportunities to prove himself in that arena, he failed. He was rejected.
He wanted so badly to be a star, to be a musician, and none of that was happening for him. He was stuck on Spahn Ranch. They basically thought that he was full of bull.
And I think when that started falling apart, drugs started to take over, and I think he kind of snapped.
Angry and bitter, a drug-fueled Manson and the family retreat to the Mojave Desert. His identity and vanity crushed beneath the weight of rejection.
It's clear that going out to the desert for an extended period of time and subjecting himself to the conditions of cold and heat, it kind of fueled the spinning out of his thought process.
Charles Manson is psychotic. Charles Manson has had a break from reality.
November 1968. The Beatles release an LP called The White Album. The record profoundly impacts Manson. While sitting around a campfire, Manson tells members of the family, now numbering more than two dozen, of a recurring vision.
He takes the song Helter Skelter on the White Album and hears it for more than it is. Helter Skelter technically is a carnival ride. It also is a phrase in the UK that kind of means to make things a little strange, a little weird. But he looked at it beyond that.
Manson believes the song Helter Skelter confirms an apocalyptic epiphany he had while in prison.
He saw the population in prisons becoming increasingly black, and they would take over a prison. So that was his view of the world, of blacks taking over. The black gangs in prisons are the biggest gangs. So he saw that. He feared that.
So he believed that a race war was coming between African Americans and whites, that he believed the African Americans would win. And not only would they win, but then he believed in a racist stance that once they won, they couldn't then handle governing themselves. And he would emerge as their Jesus Christ on earth.
Manson sells his outlandish vision to the family by keeping them high on psychedelic drugs.
When he created this culture of follow me, worship me, he turned people into followers that would do anything for him, including kill. And the killing was to bring about a war in these United States.
August 9th, 1969. Manson tells his family it's time to bring about Helter Skelter. He orders them to go to a house on Cielo Drive in the Hollywood Hills and destroy everyone in it.
Manson decided to go after that house specifically because that's the house where Terry Melcher lived.
And he told the girls before they left to leave something witchy.
Manson's killers arrive at the Cielo Drive residence around midnight and encounter Stephen Parent, an unlucky visitor who's in the wrong place at the wrong time.
He was getting into his car and he was shot to death right there. Then Tex and Linda Kasabian, Susan Atkins, and Patricia Krenwinkel went up to the house.
Inside the house are movie actress Sharon Tate, hairstylist Jay Sebring, aspiring screenwriter Wojciech Frykowski, and Abigail Folger, heiress to the Folger coffee fortune. Watson breaks into the house through a window. He then lets Atkins and Krenwinkel in through a door. A horrific bloodbath ensues.
They just took out whoever was there and just started slaughtering them. Not just killing them, I mean just cutting them up and stabbing them.
Frykowski is stabbed a total of 51 times. When he refuses to die, Watson beats him with the butt of a gun. Before they leave, the word pig is scrawled on the front door. Something witchy for Manson.
There had been celebrity murders and scandals in the past, but nothing quite as violent as this. This was so brutal, it had never been seen before in Los Angeles.
Sunshining this morning.
It is.
Yeah.
But in a twist of fate, the brutal action will lead Manson to his very first starring role.
The trial was one of the biggest circuses in history, and Charles Manson played it to the hilt.
He wanted to be a famous musician and instead became infamous for being a murderer.
If you like what you're hearing, check out Hollywood's Dark Side on Reel's channel. You'll find true stories and mysteries of celebrity icons on Autopsy that reveal what really killed American legends like Frank Sinatra, John Wayne, Aretha Franklin, and Anthony Bourdain. To find Reels on your TV, go to Reels.com. That's R-E-E-L-Z.com. Then, check the top of the screen and enter your zip code to find Reels on your system in your area.
August 9th, 1969. After the violent murders on Cielo Drive, the killers return to Spawn Ranch.
After the murders had happened, and they went and found Charlie, and they said, you know, Charlie, this is all that happened. And Charlie's like, did you wipe your prints? Did you do this? And they're like, well, you know, no.
They're all bloody. They're telling him stories. And he's like, oh, crap. These kids, they probably left a million clues. So he goes there and tries to clean it up, tries to wipe down fingerprints.
Manson also sees his visit to the crime scene as an opportunity to kickstart the race war that he believes will make him the leader of the world.
A side benefit of the murders was to try to hang it on the Black Panthers.
Hollywood wakes in horror as news of the bloody murders spreads across town.
Friday night in Los Angeles, a movie actress and four of her friends were murdered.
There was a sense of terror in Los Angeles because in the beginning, no one knew who committed the murders or why.
The circumstances were lurid.
People are fearful because they can't predict what might happen next.
Well, Hollywood went crazy after Sharon Tate and the others were murdered. People were buying dogs, they were buying guns, they were getting security. There was complete terror in the Hollywood community.
The murders scandalized and traumatized the city. The mythical peace and tranquility and mythical promise of Los Angeles in the 1960s was over.
But the one thing that hasn't happened is Manson's apocalyptic vision.
Manson wanted the race war to start from the Tate murders. When it didn't, when the world didn't go crazy, when Helter Skelter didn't start, he said, you didn't do it right. I will show you how to do it.
For Manson, who had been spurned by society and failed to become a rock star, the race war is going to make him the legend Hollywood wouldn't allow. A day after the Tate killings, an unhinged Manson and his followers hit the streets of L.A. with the intention of committing a new set of murders. This time, they plan to leave overwhelmingly obvious clues.
What is dramatically sad about the LaBianca murders is there is nothing significant about why they were chosen. Manson searches for a house, and there it was, the LaBianca house. It looked like a good house for a killing.
Charlie went in first and told them that they had basically were going to be robbed and that not to worry, they were going to tie him up and everything was going to be fine.
Then he sends his psychotic, drugged-out goons in to go butcher them.
Lino LaBianca, a supermarket owner, and his wife had both been stabbed to death, repeated stab wounds.
And they killed them in a very brutal, savage manner.
On his body, the word war had been carved in the chest.
And there was a carving fork stuck in his abdomen like, you know, he's done.
And war is what Manson hopes the LaBianca murders will unleash. His psychotic vision is written in blood for all to see. And in time, he will be crowned king of the world.
Rise was written on the wall. Helter Skelter is misspelled on the refrigerator. Death to pigs. Written in blood. But furthermore, they take Leno LaBianca's wallet and they go to a predominantly African-American area and they drop it in the back of a toilet at a service station thinking it's going to be found. Aha, African-American people have done it. And this is even more insipid. They eat watermelon and leave the rinds in the sink think that's going to somehow tip it off.
October 1969. Charles Manson and his family, now relocated to the Barker Ranch in Death Valley, are arrested on suspicion of car theft.
They go up, they get, you know, the people at the Barker, they find all the people, and Charles Manson is arrested inside of a cabinet.
Manson, who left prison with dreams of becoming famous, is now back behind bars. Soon after, police uncover Manson and the family's more insidious crimes.
The leader of the hippie clan, Charles Manson, is being returned to Los Angeles today from the desert town where he's been in jail on other charges. When the trial begins, probably in the spring, the state will attempt to prove that he gave the orders to his followers to kill.
Charlie and the family were arrested, and it was such a bizarre story, and the murders had been so high profile that the media, including myself, just went crazy.
A wandering band of members of a so-called religious cult with a leader they called Jesus has had three of its followers arrested.
When the deputies raided the camp, some of the women were nude and some wore only bikini bottoms.
Young girls supposedly under the spell of a bearded Svengali who allegedly masterminded the seven murders.
It was a field day for the press.
Police said they were heavy users of drugs.
What was fascinating about the women was that they looked like the girl down the street, the girl next door.
What do you think of this morning's proceedings, Susan?
I didn't think anything about it.
And it was shocking that they seemed to be involved almost in a Manson-type cult.
He's seen that the people that have been on the bottom, it's time for them to come to the top. You know, the revolution's on.
Manson's control over his family is now on public display.
Something else this trial has done is gather together again those members of Manson's family who are not in jail. They dance through the hallways, telling all who will listen that the defendants are innocent, and that when the trial is over, they'll all go back to the desert and live off the land.
How much more powerful can a person get than one who can, A, take his crazy, bizarre worldview, a view, really, which is pure evil in nature, and then to get a whole group of followers to all buy into the same thing, and then to go around killing people because of it. So I think we're afraid of pure evil. We're afraid of someone who's so powerful that they can harness evil and then get others to buy into it.
You couldn't write a script that was that imaginable, that the hippies were actually a cult of killers, and there were young teenage girls who had become like zombie killers from a horror movie.
There is evidence that they actually believe that Charles Manson is Jesus Christ.
The more we learned, the crazier it sounded.
In his twisted mind, he envisioned that he and his family would be the ultimate beneficiaries of a black-white civil war.
And you started learning about race wars and you know, music, and it just, it got more bizarre as it moved on.
Even though Manson is appearing in the press as an accused murderer instead of a famous singer, he relishes the spotlight. He's on the world stage now, just as he imagined.
You know, I think he enjoyed people were paying attention. He's never really had that.
Charles Manson, the leader of the peculiar commune involved in the Sharon Tate murders, told the judge today in Los Angeles that he wants to be his own lawyer.
The trial was one of the biggest circuses in history, and Charles Manson played it to the hilt.
What are your plans?
I have none.
Charles Manson is a man who would rather be infamous than anonymous. And his next performance will have the whole world watching. Summer 1970.
How you doing, Charles?
Good.
It's all a play, isn't it?
Charles Manson finally has what he's always wanted. Everyone's attention.
All my feelings are good.
The sun was out this morning. You notice it?
America is gripped by a courtroom drama more surreal than any Hollywood film, and the star attraction doesn't disappoint.
All the elements are present for one of the most sensational murder trials in American history. Seven people brutally murdered in a glare of Hollywood publicity.
It was a crazy trial. There was a story about the trial every day. It was being covered by television. Even though they didn't allow cameras in the courtroom, everybody did interviews outside court then.
But I don't think any case in history has received this much pre-trial publicity throughout the world.
I think part of what was fascinating about Charles Manson was he was a man out of control. He did not control himself in the courtroom.
You already tried, Lee. Just a minute.
He did not control himself at any point. He said and did whatever he wanted to, and especially if it was not appropriate to do so. He seemed to revel in that.
He was now the most famous criminal in history, and he played to it, and he did his eyes for the cameras, and he played Frankenstein. That was his new role, and he ran with it.
Charles Manson takes full advantage of his newfound fame. He produces an album from his prison cell and grants an exclusive interview to Rolling Stone magazine.
Making the cover of Rolling Stone? I mean, remember, this is a guy who is a sociopath. He didn't care how he got there. It was just that he made it there.
I'm sure that he was very pleased by seeing his picture on Rolling Stone. That was ultimately the irony, that he did want to be famous. He wanted to be a famous musician, and instead he became infamous for being a murderer.
Charles Manson is now on everyone's radar. Even the most powerful man in the free world knows his name.
The trial was such a circus and was so big that the President of the United States, Richard Nixon, commented on it.
I noted, for example, the coverage of the Charles Manson case when I was in Los Angeles. Here is a man who was guilty, directly or indirectly.
They should have called a mistrial by every legal law school leaning ever, but they didn't because it was Charles Manson and you can't let him go.
Manson's antics inside the courtroom become a daily distraction, and when the judge denies him permission to cross-examine a witness, he takes his performance level to an extreme.
He's feeling beyond persecuted by the judge and the system. He basically said, "You're going to do this to me, I'm going to do it to you." And there he sat, unshackled, in his seat, feet from the judge's bench, with a pencil in hand.
He jumped out of his seat and almost got to the judge.
The deputies in the courtroom pushed Charlie down. He was taken into a locked holding cell, and that was that.
Manson was a pure and total sociopath. Didn't care about rules, regulations, right, wrong. Didn't care about society and what they held as standards or norms. He cared about survival.
But a shocking revelation soon eclipses Manson's court romantics and grabs the attention of the biggest stars in Hollywood.
There was a celebrity list that came out in the Manson trial.
Steve McQueen was the biggest actor of the time. He had dated Sharon Tate, and he was on the death list.
McQueen got on the list because his production company apparently said no to a Manson script. He started carrying a gun and was scared to death.
There was rampant fear all through Hollywood that there was a war against celebrities.
Elizabeth Taylor, Richard Burton, Tom Jones, and Frank Sinatra are also reportedly on the Manson family death list. But for state prosecutor Vincent Bugliosi, the list is only circumstantial evidence, and he has the burden of proof resting on his shoulders.
Charlie knows the law. He spent most of his time in prison, so he understands that, you know, he didn't do anything. They got nothing on me. You know, I wasn't even there. He didn't think he was going to get sentenced. He didn't think he was going to jail.
They had to establish evidence that Charlie ordered the murders, and they did that through testimony of other family members. And that was testimony of the influence that Manson had over his followers.
That's the district attorney. I'm nobody's leader. And I'm nobody's follower.
During the trial, his family follows his every command, playing right into the hands of the prosecution.
It appears that he has a scab in the form of an X on his forehead in blood. It apparently was done with a razor blade.
8 months of one side, the public has heard, and nothing else. They've thrown the Constitution in the wastebasket.
Manson cuts an X in his forehead, stating, "I have been X'd out of existence." So all of the people who are his followers, both on trial and outside of the courtroom, cut X's into their foreheads.
His disciples were protesting and sitting outside, looking horrific, bald head women with X's on their forehead.
It's all a matter of time now. We know where we're going.
Where?
To the desert. You can't kill love.
It was a horror movie come to life that gripped the entire world.
They would crawl up the steps of the courthouse, the brainwash, the mind F, if you will, whatever power he had on them, carried them straight into their life prison sentences.
He was still controlling them, even though they were separated. He felt, in certain ways, untouchable. And the girls in particular were just not in touch with reality. They were living in a bubble. They were living in their own reality.
Charles Manson's need to control and manipulate others proves to be his greatest achievement, but it will lead to his undoing. After 7 months on trial, his one-man show comes to an end.
The jury hearing the charges against Charles Manson and three girl members of his so-called family brought in its verdict this afternoon. All were found guilty of murder in the first degree.
The verdicts were guilty and death. And the media response was, okay, that's what we expected.
Manson is burned by the fame he sought his whole life.
It was all over the newspapers. And Vince Bugliosi, he was brilliant.
The complexity of this trial was just staggering.
Proving that, in fact, Manson should be convicted of murder itself, not just conspiracy to commit murder.
But even a murder conviction and a date with the gas chamber isn't enough to deter Manson from pursuing fame.
Charles Manson has made his way into rock and roll.
He's the celebrity criminal now.
I can do anything I want to you people at any time I want to, because that's what you've done to me.
After a 7-month trial that rivals any drama seen on television, Charles Manson is convicted of multiple counts of murder. The heavily publicized case has given Manson exactly what he wants, to become one of the most famous faces in America.
Charles Manson was the first celebrity criminal. And he ended up becoming famous across America because of the evil acts he did. And in many ways, this is a break from old school America, where the only people that got recognition were the ones who did good. All of a sudden, we've got someone who did despicable acts, and he's as famous as any of those good people, quote unquote.
February 1972. The state of California abolishes capital punishment, and Manson, after years in and out of prison, is behind bars for life. But prison walls won't contain him or his need for fame.
I'm not going to sit in that damn chair, man. I'll stand here and talk with the dude. I don't want to sit in no damn chair, man. What's wrong with that? You get a stool?
The sit-down sessions he grants are the convict's thinly veiled attempt to retry his case in the court of public opinion.
I didn't kill anyone. I didn't order anyone to be killed. I'm nobody's leader, and I'm nobody's follower.
Over the years, Manson's television interviews have become increasingly bitter and bizarre.
Do you feel blame? Are you mad? Do you feel like Wolves Kebab Fred Fanish?
Where there's a camera, Manson sees an opportunity. He's a performer, constantly playing to his audience, giving them what they want.
Maybe I should have killed 400 or 500 people, then I would have felt better.
Time has masked the grisly horror of the Tate and LaBianca murders. And to some, Charles Manson has come to symbolize a rebellious anti-authority outlaw. The failed musician's appeal has extended to some of rock and roll's edgier acts.
Charles Manson has made his way into rock and roll. Guns N' Roses has recorded one of his songs, Look at Your Game, Girl. Lemonheads recorded one. Nine Inch Nails recorded at Cielo Drive Home.
Manson's legacy lives on, and like all great acts, he leaves his audience wanting more. In November of 2013, Manson appears in Rolling Stone magazine for a second time, proving that interest in the cult leader has passed on to a whole new generation.
This is a constant fascination with each new generation of people who discover the Manson story. It was very different looking from the way that he once looked. But still, underneath it all, underneath the gray hair, there is that sense of profound danger, and it's hard to look away.
Charles Manson is a man whose hunger for fame and power drove him past the breaking point and into the realm of murder. It's an ugly, bloody legacy, one that will never be X'd out of society.
If you look at what was driving his actions while in Los Angeles, especially, he wanted to be famous and he wanted to be known as a rock star. I certainly think that Charles Manson is a reminder of what great lengths people will go to become famous, and that the drive for celebrity can become its own disease.
If you spit in my face and smack me in the mouth and throw me in solitary confinement for nothing, what do you think's going to happen when I get out of here?
Hollywood Scandals comes from the Dark Hollywood Collection at Reels Channel. To get more like this when you watch TV, go to Reels.com. That's R-E-E-L-Z.com. Check the top of your screen and enter your zip code to find us on your system. You'll also find extras from the latest real crime programs that are only on Reels. Find Hollywood Scandals and its companions on Roku and Fire TV, too.